Hello, super urbanists. I'm really chuffed that we have such a international listenership here on Super Urbanism. I should probably explain to that listenership that chuffed is a positive, pleasant sensation that British people occasionally feel when they're queuing. But forgive us if we do go into something that seems even more British than being chuffed or queuing. It may seem incredible to our foreign friends, but in Britain right now, one of the most promising means of making a new settlement and thereby building a huge number of the houses the country desperately needs is a project called Forest City, led by two figures, an impressive young campaigner called Joe Reeve and Shiv Malik, our guest today. Shiv is going to describe how he, a journalist, became the leading light in a movement to build a place for 1 million people somewhere near Cambridge. Shiv was one of the first to explain what is now political orthodoxy in this country in his book Jilted Generation, which was published in 2010, that an entire generation was being priced out of lives that their parents took for granted, and how why housing was key in this. His book set out what is now perhaps the background issue to both politics and architecture in this country for years to come. There are echoes in every single nation, although in Britain it's most pointy, sharp and unpleasant. I spoke to Shiv about why he wants to build a city. But first asked him, I spoke to Shiv about why he wants to build a city. First, I asked him, though, where the idea came from. Can you tell me how you came to write Jilted Generation?
It was about 2009, and your job as a journalist is obviously to observe the world and see what's going on. And part of that is digging out, as I did, very specific stories, but other things are just much more wider, like societal changes. And those stories are always harder because you don't know how to peg them and what to do. But if you want, I was first on the scene for the financial crash, but I remember being on Golders Green High Street, which is basically where I lived at the time, and seeing a queue form for Northern Rock and going, oh, this is bad. There's a line outside of a bank. It's historically always a bad sign. Growing up, well, then I was about 26, 27, so still pretty junior, though I'd done a lot. I'd done some war reporting in Afghanistan, worked on July 7th, published a huge piece on that, investigatory piece, which took me over a year. So the financial crash happened, and then I could also see something else going on, which is where my peers were compared to where my parents were. And it's a pretty simple exercise. Are people roughly at the same age having kids, buying homes, moving on with their lives, career progression, etc., etc.? And I could see that we were definitely living delayed lives. And I was born in 1981, so I was an elder millennial, which I'm not sure I knew that nomenclature at that time. But what was clear to me is then I was the first, with the millennials, if you look at the demographics, we're like the children of the baby boomers. And I was the earliest of that wave, so I was at the front of this kind of demographic cohort. I didn't quite know all of this, but I could see something's going on. So I talked to who would then be my co-author at the time, a guy called Ed Hauker, incredibly articulate, much better writer than me, certainly then, probably even now, and much more au fait with politics than I was. And we got chatting, and we were initially going to call this book The Rolling Stones Must Die, because it was looking at culture. And I think at that moment, the Rolling Stones basically were headlining Glastonbury. And I was like personally offended by this. I thought, what the hell? If you'd gone back to Woodstock, right, in 69 or whatever, and like a skiffle band from the 20s were headlining, they were the big deal, you'd be outraged. You'd be like, what the hell's going on with society and culture? And aren't we atrophying? So we were going to call it that. And the publishers, when we then took it to them and pitched it, independent publishers, they were like, oh, you can't call it that. It's going to cause all sorts of trouble. But we should have stuck to our guns because we made a much better title, in my view. But then I spent a month. We had 3 months, in effect, to write this book from beginning to end. And I spent a month, the first month, in the British Library, wading through national statistics. And then quickly realizing that actually what we thought was a cultural thing was just a kind of manifestation of what was going on economically. And all the signs read. And what the book then eventually came to say was, look, if we don't sort out housing and infrastructure, millennials will have a terrible time of it, possibly worse than their parents, which would obviously be the first time in economic history that's happened. And really, we're just not doing any of the same things we used to do to make those things function and allow people to buy homes, have children, and progress in their careers. So there you go. Long answer, but
that's 2010 when the book was published. That narrative has, in the last 5-10 years, increased in volume.
It has. And in fact, at the time, it turned out that David Willetts, we're also just publishing a book at that time. He's Lord Willetts now, but he was a prominent Conservative minister. And he wrote a book called The Pinch. And his book was very much focused on boomers. And we're a terrible generation for not having given enough to our children. Whereas ours was like, this is the lives we're living now. And this is the actual result of what's going on. And we spent 5 years touring this book and lots of festivals in the UK. But then we also went off to the Sydney Opera House and got to speak there, which was an amazing privilege. And it was funny because we also heard from Australians, oh, we've got these housing too. And I was like, are you kidding me? You've got a giant continent to build homes. What's your problem? And it turns out now they're really suffering. And those whispers were first raised back then. I think it was 2011-12 when I went. And it's become a very accepted argument. And I was always disappointed that millennials really didn't take this on. It was boomers who'd show up to these meetings for the book. But millennials wouldn't show. They always would prefer, in a sense, to blame themselves. Or they thought it was their fault. I have not worked hard enough and therefore I haven't been able to afford a home. It's embarrassing to have to ask my parents or just keep living with them, right? And so it became about, this isn't about politics, it's not structural, and no one accepted that argument. Now, however, something snapped about a year or 2 years ago in the body politic in this country. We've got not just millennials, but the Gen Zers, as they're known. And they're far more feisty, it would seem. I think COVID helped with understanding that there are big forces out in the world which are not your fault personally. They seem to be a bit more kind of political. But yes, everyone's imbibed this argument. It's very disappointing because nothing got done about it either.
You mentioned in a previous podcast, the Anglo-Futurist podcast, that Claire Fox, Baroness Fox, to give her full title, responded to your, I don't know exactly the circumstances, but she said that, aren't you just whinging? Perhaps you could tell me a little bit about that review and how fair it was and how it settled with you. When did that take place?
When you write a book, lots of people pat you on the back and say, well done for writing a book. And writing a book's difficult, but you'll feel pretty chuffed with yourself, etc. But of course, there'll be once in a while someone will come up to you and go, hang on, here's the real critique of what's going on. And Claire Fox was one of those people. And at the time, we were both actually panelists on The Moral Maze. So we just bump into her every couple of months or so. And she said this. She said, look, well done, everyone writing the book, but what are you actually doing? Isn't this just a giant whinge? How are you going to actually fix any of these problems? And I thought to myself, look, I thought writing a book's good enough, isn't it? Just talking about it, isn't that good enough? But it turns out it wasn't. And that always stuck with me because I thought, oh God, she's right. How do I retort except to say that she's correct? So it really annoyed me. And it was, yeah, I guess it brings us up to the current moment where I decided none of this stuff is getting solved. I guess I better do something about it, which is a crazy notion, but there you go.
You gloss over quite a bit by saying, and therefore I decided to build a city. I suppose there is a huge, wonderful logic to it, but it's also not the logic that most people ascribe to or live by. Perhaps you could tell me in a more granular way how that decision came and what you did with that desire and that motivation.
So I got disenchanted post-writing the book. And I think I got disenchanted because nothing was being done. Every year from 2015-16 onwards seemed to get a bit worse and a bit worse and a lot worse, and Trump, Brexit, etc. And it was quite a depressing time. Right now, there's this nostalgia moment for 2016, but it wasn't fun. It was certainly very tumultuous.
There's nostalgia for 2016?
Yeah, you should be on Instagram more, apparently, to see all of this.
I'm never going on Instagram again, jeez.
So I then thought, okay, well, look, who are the main blockers to housing? Yes, there's the government, but let's start with the NIMBYs. What do they actually say? So I spent a couple of years listening to NIMBYs and also listening to people who are doing housing in an innovative way, so the community land trust people. Casually, not in a kind of intense way with a project in mind. So I'd go and talk to people. And NIMBYs always said the same three things, right? Which was,
These houses that people build are ugly, especially the kind of edge of town developments. They never come with any infrastructure. And when they are finally built, they're as expensive as anything else on the market. So why did we go through all this pain? And I thought to myself, oh God, I agree with you. They are right. Oh dear. And I think from an intellectual journey, it actually then doesn't take you very long to get to a city. Because you go, you've got to do placemaking at scale. And how did we do it before? Look, what's the history of Milton Keynes? And the new towns don't really work. None of them have ever come about and been good in terms of the economics behind them. They're never self-funding, or rarely have been, and certainly not now. So then you think, okay, we've got to do it bigger, because you had the commercial land then effectively brought in. So people aren't commuting. They're not living somewhere that they can move to somewhere else and do their work. They can just be in the same place. So that makes sense. And then you're already at a city, right? And then you think, where and exactly how? I gave a speech in about 2020. This was in the very start of the pandemic. I spent a couple of minutes elucidating a plan for building 10 cities along community land trust principles with Canary Wharf style perks for commerce. So I guess that was really the proper formulation of it. And it was a wild idea at the time, but that's the abundance agenda. That was me trying to be provocative, saying, look, this is what we should be doing. But I didn't think I should be doing it, right? That was a different moment. And that only came basically last year, because I'd spotted the zeitgeist having shifted and thought, I can talk about that if you want.
Yeah. That's very interesting that you spotted the zeitgeist being lifted. Was there a moment where you thought things, what's going on here?
There really was. It was the looking for growth movement. Now you've heard that story of having written this book, waiting for other people to join, or millennials especially, being disappointed, etc. So then this group just popped out of nowhere, seemingly, called Looking for Growth. And I thought, isn't that weird? Like, why do you need a campaigning group for a growing economy? That's just been a staple of British politics, but also a pretty stable trend for 150 years. And suddenly now people are like, no, we need economic growth. Surely that's just obvious. But they also had loads of people show up to their meetings, so they were being successful in garnering this attention. I'd been to one of their meetings before, but then I showed up. There's about 250 people in a pub in Camden. They were spilling out of the door, and I met Joe, who's now my co-founder for Forest City, and I started talking to him about the city idea.
Tell me about Joe. Who is he?
Joe Reeve is 28 and he had a different journey to me, really. But I'd probably describe him succinctly like this. He's one of the greatest social and political campaigners of his generation. He's got this amazing energy that he brings to almost everything. What he's probably best known for is the guy who went and started cleaning the tube in London, because he didn't like the graffiti, like almost everyone. But he decided to do something about it. So his slogan was, you can just do things. He ran a group called Future House, which is like a think tank plus dinners, and got the big list together of people who were interested in doing something, but they weren't quite sure. And then he started Looking for Growth, which has grown into an organization of thousands of members. They've been incredibly successful at getting government to do big things like the infrastructure bill. And he said this in that speech in March when he got up on stage. He said, look, the cavalry isn't coming. And you realize, okay, nothing's going to happen otherwise. Why do I expect other people to do this? It's on me.
And that was effectively answering a doubt, an issue you'd been having in your mind.
Yeah, look, it's a ridiculous proposition that I, with no development experience, no experience in construction until very recently, my dad has a construction business. It was a very small one, but no requisite experience in high politics or whatever it might be. I'm not an economist either, all right? Why would I be the one to build a city? And the only comfort in that is the last person who really set about this task in a transformative way was Ebenezer Howard. Who was a journalist, it turns out.
He was a failed farmer and worked for Hansard.
The transformative period of his life is supposed to be when he worked for the Chicago Tribune during the Great Fire of Chicago. Then he got to see the rebuilding of a place and presumably then started thinking about placemaking and what could be done. But it was a long journey for him. He wrote Tomorrow, his book in, I think, 1901, but it took him 20 years to both campaign and then put the money together for Welland Garden City.
To the idea of Forest City, is it possible to break down the evolution of it? If you conceptualise the idea that to work at scale, it has to be a city. You've articulated that in 2020. How do the ideas, other ideas for Forest City fall in?
There are three things, in short, that make Forest City unique as a proposition, aside from just being in the first in Britain in 50 plus years. The first is a community land trust. The second is this special economic zone or Canary Wharf style incentives for business. And then the third is the forest itself and the way in which the relationship with nature is reformulated. I'll start where I started, which was the community land trust. Obviously, you want to build beautiful houses, but you also want to build affordable houses. The intergenerational argument then becomes, why don't you use this vehicle called a community land trust? Because it actually kicks the land value uplift down the road. And it's actually future generations who kind of really bank that discount. So what is a community land trust? From the end user perspective, the person buying the house, is very simple. You buy a house at a huge discount, and then you have to sell it back to the buyer, the city in this case, roughly the price that you bought it for, plus a little bit extra as a reward, in inflation, etc. But that's basically the scheme. So we want to build for the prototypical kind of housing unit, four-bedroom terraced house, 1,900 square foot. The modelling that we've done suggests that we can sell this for £350,000, including the land costs, including up to first fix. You've got your basic kind of plumbing and electrics in, right? That would mean people would be buying these homes at £350,000, still a lot of money, but it's a hell of a lot cheaper than anywhere in Cambridge, where this place is located, which costs you £1 million, and in London, which costs you upwards of £1 million for sure. So this is cheap. If you live anywhere in the southeast, cheap. Great. So that's the first part. One other thing to say about that is I studied, obviously, very intently what happened with council housing, because from an intergenerational perspective, you're selling off an asset which had taken many generations, creating a communal benefit for everyone. And then one generation goes, yeah, sell it all to us and we'll bank that profit. The same thing happened even more offensively with mutual banks. Outrageous. Thatcher says, no, you've got to basically offer your membership. You've got to demutualize. You've got to offer them that bargain, which is outrageous. 150 years of running a community bank, and then you've got to sell it all to one generation so they can bank the profit. Again, these things outrage me, and I realized handing it over to democratic control also isn't a safeguard because people voted for Thatcher many times over. So what do you do? And the community land trust again says, okay, look, we'll hold that asset in trust, a bit like the City of London, if you want, or many other kind of housing providers have these kinds of schemes. We'll hold it in trust and we'll steward this asset through many decades. And I love that setup. I think it's great.
How did you settle upon the place? And perhaps you could describe the place first and foremost so everyone knows where it is.
We're setting out to build 400,000 homes, thereabouts. And everyone's in the kind of new town mentality. So you've got to have a station there. You've got to have a major road connection. And if you don't, then that's it. Don't even think about it. And now it turns out if you have a country where there's not much hard infrastructure like that, then your choices are really limited. But then you want to turn and flip the script and say to people, if you had a city of 1 million people, do you really think there wouldn't be a train station? And they go, oh, no, of course we'd have it. There you go. That's your answer. So start really with the plot. You're trying to look for, if you want to get this community land trust stuff off the ground, the houses to be cheap, then you need cheap land. Because if it's expensive, it's never going to happen. So now you're looking for a huge agricultural plot and it's got to be next to somewhere already that clearly has agglomeration value. And the top of everyone's list is always Cambridge. Oxford is probably next on the list, but everyone knows you can't really do any building around there. So forget about it. So now you've already narrowed your field very quickly. And we did a study and spent, again, a year really trying to think through. I've drove around loads of places, talking to a few people here and there, but maybe mainly just trying to find a suitable spot because it needs to be investable. The Treasury needs to back it. The country needs to realize what needs to happen. And the place that you're dealing with, Cambridge in this case, needs to have a massive space constraint so you can clearly demonstrate you're going to have demand. So it's going to be Cambridge. The rational thing to do would be to expand Cambridge itself. That isn't going to happen is because imagine expanding Cambridge by three times and then trying to put in a tram network down Cambridge's medieval streets. People then go, oh yeah, God, that's going to be a nightmare. And then it just doesn't happen. So then you're looking for 45,000 acres. And the land has got to be cheap. It's got to be agricultural land. And it's got to be contiguous. And it's got to be near Cambridge, right? Now you've really narrowed this down. And that's why we basically picked the plot that we have, which is between Newmarket and Haverhill. And if you live in London, you want to know how big that is. It's from Hampstead to Dulwich, where 2.6 million people live. The density kind of works out because there's only 1 million people. In our case, but that's where it is.
The form of the city, how did that evolve from the decision, okay, this is where we are, this is the kind of place we want?
Yeah, there were some basic things that we knew that I pushed for in that vision initially, which was we're going to have it as a community land trust, right? And all developers will say, how are you going to sell these houses? Great, we've got a great scheme to sell these houses because they're dirt cheap compared to everyone else. And they're also amazing quality. That means we can just keep building rapidly because we can sell them. But in order to fund that, you've got to have that commercial land that you're also selling. So we've got 8,000 acres that are dedicated to commercial land. And that's commercial on all sorts. So it's on one side, it's partly amenities. And on the other side, it's going to be a central business district. And then the other part is obviously light industrial and the like. So it's everything that a city would contain, obviously, because it is a city. And this isn't just to get this through politically. I want to live in this place. So I don't want it to be just a concrete jungle. I've lived and visited lots of cities around the world. None of them really, truly appeal to me from a natural perspective, right? I don't think anyone's really cracked that, because partly because no one's really built cities in the 21st century when our ecological thinking is far more developed than it was in the 1960s. And so having a forest wend its way through, around, was it going to be a donut? These are the questions that we're now starting to answer. We've got some fascinating answers, but we started with that. You've got the housing, you've got to have 8,000 acres of commercial land, and you've got to be able to create this 12,000 acre forest. So those were really where we started. So it's really vision-led planning.
As you're talking about this, there's a background thinking. I was like, how is he affording to do this? How are they affording to spend time on the thinking for this? How are you and Joe doing it?
The answer is we're doing it all the wrong way. Jackie Sadock said something to me. Jackie Sadock is the chair of the Cambridge to London Innovation Corridor. And she's a pretty prominent star in the construction industry. And deservedly, she's an amazing powerhouse of kind of energy and experience. And she gave this comment in the Telegraph about Forest City. I'd not met her to that point. But she basically said, this is a madcap scheme. Which, fair enough, it is. And anyway, I thought, great, I'll give her a call and see if I can win her over. I kind of gave her the update and said, this is where we are. So she said, I don't know, Shiv, how you've managed to get so far by doing it all the wrong way. Now I'm starting to know her. It's classic Jackie. And she's right. We basically started with no money, no control over the land, no experience, no particular political contacts. And we managed to achieve a lot in a very short period of time. How have we done it? In short, it's because we are doing it the wrong way. If we were developers and we said, we're going to build a city, everyone would have shot us down instantly. You're just trying to get rich. If we were local politicians, the constituents would have come and ruined that prospect anyway. We're volunteers who, granted, don't know anything, but we're learning every day very quickly, who are volunteers who are just passionate about what? In my case, and for most people's case, is repairing that social contract. Can I, as someone who's under 45 in this country, buy a home, raise a family through working hard? And if you can't do that, which you can't do, then this country is broken. And everyone now knows that. So that's how I usually say, look, I'm not interested in building cities. And that's true, I'm not. Someone came to me and said, Shiv, but you could build this city in Indonesia or Bolivia. It'd be so much easier, Shiv. I said, look, let me stop you right there. I don't care about cities. I don't care about building cities. I care about the social contract. And a city is a vehicle. In this case, Forest City in particular, is a vehicle for getting that repaired. So that's what I care about.
This sounds very self-evident, perhaps, but how would building a city repair the social contract?
I think it's really important to feeling secure enough to have children. If you're then also in a place where things function incredibly well, your productivity is high, you'll presumably get paid more, and certainly your pay packet will already go further. That's just the basic economic logic of this, which is why we've got some kind of great economists already backing us, because they know this too. So you have to basically free young people from their debt servitude, all right? Either it's a mortgage, or it's a landlord, or on top of that now, horrific kind of student debt, right? If you don't free those people to then not just be able to spend money, right, but it's actually be creative and take risks. A small percentage of those people will do that because they're minded to do it. But even if you denude your chances further of that small percentage already doing it, then you ruin your country because then you don't get your entrepreneurs and you end up with the Rolling Stones constantly performing until their dying breath, right? Because the new bands aren't coming through because no one has the money to go to a club at night to go and see those new bands and support them. And that happens writ large across the arts, across starting a business, whatever it might be. Like, everyone quietly knows this, but no one is trying to fix it. So you need a place where you free people from the biggest cost, give them that freedom, economic freedom, to run the country, in effect, grow it. So that's how it works. I'll add one other thing. Businesses love this place, right? Because they know they can pay their employees $100,000 plus, right? You need a place that businesses love because they know that their employees then will be able to do something with that pay packet, even though it's ludicrously, seemingly very high. It frees them and it frees businesses then to do themselves also just build the infrastructure that they need. This is a yes city from that perspective.
If we put the time frame as to around a year in which the Forest City has been going, what surprised you the most? I'm thinking about the responses to what you're doing.
I think that it's that anyone has said yes at all. There was a poll in the Telegraph, and this is Telegraph subscribers only, and let's take their mean subscriber base as 55 plus at least, right? And it was split 60 against, but 40% in favour. I thought, my God, if we're winning 40% of Telegraph readers, we're there. Stuff like that surprised me. And obviously the individuals involved, you turn up at a landowner who owns 3,000 acres and you expect to be laughed out the door or being told, are you joking? This is my long-term family legacy. I'd never do anything. Just bugger off. And they know the state of the country as well. Right? They share exactly the same arguments. Now, that doesn't mean that they say, okay, fine, you can option my land. But it gets you 80% of the way there because they know how desperate things are out there. And then they go, okay, look, this might just work.
Do you ever feel frustrated that the burden should fall on you to be able to address this?
No, there wasn't a burden hanging around, right? The cavalry isn't coming. It's just us. Fine, let's just solve it. And then, of course, it's a massive blessing. I love this job, right? It doesn't pay me anything, but I love it because why? I get to meet fascinating people all the time, which is what I loved about being a journalist, right? And I get to interact with them and also then, yes, sell them and be a positive person, right? I'm trying to do something which I think is amazing and that clearly shines through. It's very easy for me to be that person because I believe in it. So it's a wonderful privilege. On the other side, I'll tell you why it will be a burden is when it gets even more real and suddenly the weight of expectations is, okay, is this going to be another HS2? Because if we don't do this right, if the soul of this project is lost at some point and it just becomes another housing development, but writ large, Britain will never build another thing after this. Two failures in a row like that, I'm not sure we'll recover. So that's the bit that keeps me awake at night.
I don't know. I feel that I write a lot about the history of development and architecture, and I've just been writing about this beautiful housing project called Le Logis Floréal, which is in the suburbs of Brussels. The Belgians were perhaps the country that built the greatest garden cities. Even as the world was bombing Belgium to bits, their Department of Reconstruction was based in London, imbibing deeply the lessons of Ebenezer Howard. They went back in 1919 and set up an arm's length bank, which funded cooperatives to go out and build houses. This amazing project in the southeast of Brussels was built to astonishingly beautiful garden cities, what we might think of as a garden suburb, really. And it's just utterly wonderful. But even then, on its own terms, it didn't do what they wanted it to do. They had this vision. It fell short. Not to, shall we say, dilute your vision, but to deliver that in the real world is to already deal with some form of quote-unquote failure.
But we obviously have our own garden suburb, and it was Lutyens, I think, was the main sort of architect for the central square. So I lived next to that, so I also saw that and grew up around it. One, like, you would awe at how amazing this place was, but also then when I dug in a little bit further as I got older, I was like, oh, this was supposed to be for poor and rich alike. But that didn't work out, and it didn't work out for lots of reasons, partly because of the First World War and land prices and the like, but also because they didn't do a thing like a community land trust, right? And we've got Bourneville as another kind of example, exemplar of that. So there's these issues that come with thinking and doing that planning ahead and getting the economic framework right on top of it. But the other thing is, to retort to your retort, I don't know. I think I'm a bit more sceptical about the country and where it is right now. Our capacity to accept failure. Really, all countries should be judged on their ability to accept failures and how they do that and how they manage it. Because, you know, you're going to have loads of follies, both from an infrastructure, architecture perspective. But just generally speaking, you're going to make mistakes, right? And if you're not making mistakes, you're not really taking risks. That's really why you need to be able to accept your failures as well. But I think if we had another major blow, and not elevating Forest City to that status quite yet, because it's not being commissioned by the government. It's often what people say to me, oh, we can't do HS2. How are we, can't even fix the pothole ship. How are we going to build a city? The uninformed response is usually what I get.
You mentioned a moment in which there was a change, there was a kind of tipping point. We're entering into a really interesting social philosophical idea about failure and risk. But doesn't the desire and urgency that informs your project come from the HS2 moment? These were the cleverest guys in the room. These were the people that we may have not looked up to them. We may not have really agreed with them, but we believed in their technocratic abilities. We believed in their vision. We believed in what they were doing, and they've really not delivered. And I almost sense that we have that technocratic infrastructure, which was such a disaster. And then there's you who are like, we are the opposite to that. And
give us an equal chance to screw it up too. No. Actually, someone said that to me. So they said that exact same argument. I would say this on that front, which is, you're right. It's just insane that it would cost give or take £100 billion to build, 150 miles of railway, right, at high speed. And that is with all of that ambition denuded, right, to connect to Leeds, to Manchester, etc. And it is incredibly depressing. You're right. I think that was one of the formative moments that kind of changed the zeitgeist. So we've got to do something big. I think that the main driver wasn't the failure of HS2. It was the fact that we've been stagnating for 15 years as an economy. And anyone old enough to remember what it was like to not stagnate goes, oh my God, this isn't a blip. We're not just in a little recession for a year or 3 years. This is permanent. And it took them a long time. People look at graphs and go, oh, but the trend line will go up, surely. And it doesn't, and it doesn't, and it doesn't. So I think that was the main driver for the zeitgeist change, not HS2. But you're right. It does mean that we can come along and go, on one hand, okay, look, we're not those super qualified technocratic people, and we are going to do it differently. There's no playbook for building a city. So whatever that playbook was anyway, we'll throw it out and do it completely the wrong way, to quote Jackie Selleck. And it turns out it looks like it's working. We're making huge progress for people who only started 4 months ago and have zero money. We've got about 10,000 acres in a kind of yes to warm category. And we've had lots of other successes as well, talking to lots of people and all the stakeholders. So we do get that charitable. I don't know how long it'll last.
I don't want to oversell the HS2 analogy, but there's the Labour government and they're coming in and looking at what HS2 was and going, we're going to have to really look at our planning legislation and our planning culture, not just in terms of housing delivery, but manner of infrastructure. And you are, as you've alluded to, benefiting or riding a kind of change in attitude. Mm. How important... And I'm guessing that one of the ways in which you've thrived is because you don't have political allegiance, is because you're just doing you. Is it a deliberate thing, or has it just come from the desire to be authentic to your original decision?
I'll answer that by saying, look, what is this company we set up called ACDC, the Albion City Development Corporation? What is it actually intended to do? And the shortest version is to say, deliver everything on a silver platter to the government so they can pass legislation, create a development corporation, and then do the building themselves. No one's expecting, in a sense, ACDC as it is now, with 40 volunteers to do the building, per se, and be the master developer at that stage. But we will do everything beforehand. It's a bit like SEBCO with the Olympics, right? SEBCO didn't know how to build a stadium. He was a runner and very successful Olympic athlete. That's the role that we're performing. That also means that we've got to do some of the planning beforehand, right? Seb had to persuade the Olympic Committee and bring everyone in London together. But it's a job of politics and lobbying, by and large. Now, that is something that I think I can do, right? And Joe is clearly very good at. But it does also mean we have to do some of that practical, spatial work, master planning work beforehand, for sure, and retain a sense of what this vision is for this city. But I think that's why we're succeeding, and where maybe the HS2 lot didn't succeed, right? Because most of this was just politics and they didn't get it, right?
One of the reasons why you've made so many strides is a certain political neutrality in the fact that you don't come from, it's not a top-down thing, the Garden Cities, Dave Barkler, Brown, and then Cameron of this kind of, oh Jesus, do we have to take this seriously again? Whereas in actual fact, this is something that has its own engine, although that engine is a desperate desire to fix the problems of the country, which is not necessarily incredibly positive when you think about it. But anyway, it's hugely commendable and is a huge engine to what you're doing, I think. But there's also, with that political neutrality, is almost an aesthetic neutrality. The listeners of this podcast are largely architects and designers. Ask not what your country can do for you, but what you can do for your country. What can architects and designers do other than simply by signing up to your pledge or simply by applauding you?
Leaving aside all the elements of master planning, which are vast, what are you left with? One of my problems, that's a long list of things to resolve and solve, is what is the aesthetic of Forest City? And it is a narrow and then very broad question, etc. So you can take it at the broadest sense. What does it also literally look like when we have to deliver some renders at some point to people? Because we live in a visual society and people want to know, okay, what does it look like? And if I went around saying, oh, and I'll give you the problem more succinctly, if I said, we're just going to build Bath writ large, right? I think a lot of people would go, wow, okay, I love Bath, right? Now, if you're a modern, not a modernist, but a modern like me, there's a massive problem here, right? Which is this. If you go in for the kind of Leon Krier school of new urbanism, right? You're like, brilliant. They've got all the placemaking. They've rethought all of that. They've realized most of the modernists went wrong. And, you know, Corbusier's visions of people walking in the skies. It hasn't worked, generally speaking. There's a lot of that went wrong on both placemaking side of things. But then you go, his solution for the literal aesthetic, right, is to go, just copy the past, right? Let's just go, it's a pastiche, right? And Poundbury is, for all of its great things, it's a pastiche. And that's very problematic. Why? Because if you believe, like me, that the future should be better than the past, then to concede on the aesthetics, to say, the past has got it right, and there's no development, there's no movement, there's no shift, there's no saying, actually, no, we're doing something brave and new because the future is better than the past, I just can't abide with it. So I've been in a, at best, kind of amateur gentleman kind of way, reading in to and trying to figure out, along with a bunch of designers and some architects, but mainly actually on the design side, what does this new aesthetic look like? Where do we get our inspiration from to bounce off? What are the bouncing off points in and around things like beauty, right? Where does that sit? And again, those debates are basically like, oh, look, all of classical architecture, they got beauty right, let's just copy them. And it's just not, it's deficient. It's not good enough. Patrick Collinson from Stripe has put out that grant saying, look, we'll just give up to $250,000 to people who can come up with new aesthetics. I think that's the right thing to do. The aesthetics need to be informed by a value system. So you can't just go, oh, we'll just copy the Bauhaus. The Bauhaus came up with some nice colour designs. They didn't. They thought about the world in a completely different way, and that's what informed their output. So if people are thinking, and there are people, and they're usually small architectural practices who do the creative stuff, but they have no outlet for it. That's who I want to be hearing from quite soon on that front. The person in charge of, in effect, design and at the moment on our expert committee is a guy called Edward Collinson. He grew up in North Yorkshire and he studied in fine arts, worked with wood and material science and more than that, all the kind of internal materials, but interiors mainly. But he's really become incredibly proficient in how, as a major kind of a business that he runs with employing many people, etc. Usually working for quite rich clients out in the west coast of America. But I've asked him, I said, look, I trust your sensibilities on this. Create me the house and give me the look, right, for that prototypical four-bedroom house. It needs to look beautiful and also have a new aesthetic that's set aside from this. So the challenge is with him at the moment, but it's a much broader challenge that he won't be able to solve. Last thing to say is a city is a big thing. It contains all life, multiplicities of everything. And it will have many neighbourhoods. So there are many different aesthetic styles that hopefully fit together in some kind of whole pattern book, I should say. But yeah, that's the challenge that I'm facing.
Last question. How can any listener to this podcast help and support you?
Definitely sign our pledge. We've got an architecture competition currently running, a design competition for lampposts. That's probably going to be closed quite soon, but we will have several more where we'll be thinking around manhole covers, design, street signs, and trying to get that language together, right? Like, how does it hang together so it's got a sensibility and aesthetic? So apply to those, spread the word, let architects get excited about placemaking in the UK itself, and reach out personally. I will take time out every day to speak to all sorts of people. So just reach out. We're on Twitter. LinkedIn is the other one.
Shiv Malik on LinkedIn. You said you spend your time reaching out to lots of people and talking about it. You've done that to us. Thank you very much.
This has been an absolute pleasure, Tim. Thank you.
Yes, there is a particularly British quality to Forest City. Just as there's a British quality to the name Northern Rock, which was the building society, which highlighted the impending banking crisis in 2008. As Shiv alludes to, this is the country in which Ebenezer Howard developed his ideas on garden cities, in which economics, geography, urban planning and architecture were melded together to offer a solution to the crisis then facing Britain at the beginning of the 20th century. Urban deprivation, rural unemployment. As an aside, I think the British have a capacity for creating such big problems that they need huge solutions to solve them. Howard was no expert, but worked on his ideas endlessly, which resulted in a book first, and then a place, Letchworth, and then another place, and then more, and then others around the world. Howard was a journalist who stepped from behind the typewriter to solve the problem in front of him. There are garden cities now in Czechia, the USA. There's a garden city in Morocco. I love the motto adopted by Joe Reeve at the Looking for Growth group as well. The cavalry isn't coming, we are the cavalry. Now, I think there's more than enough in what they're doing for me personally to offer my support. Things don't ever turn out as you plan, but the importance is to have a plan. I look forward to hearing from them how things to go on, and I'm pledging my support. I think you should too. I don't think, like Shiv, that the hopes of Britain rely on it, but it would help. It would help everyone. Onwards, super urbanists!